Hello and welcome to Tantramar Report on CHMA 106.9 FM. We're broadcasting from Sackville, New Brunswick, the heart of the Maritimes, on the traditional and unceded lands of the Mi'kmaq people. I'm Erica Butler. It's Wednesday, January 26th. Coming up on today's show.
The biggest barrier identified was ourselves. We're not taking this seriously enough.
That's Margaret Tuse King, who recently organized a community conversation on the topic of green resilience, incorporating concern for the effects of climate change with those for income security and economic fairness. Coming up shortly, David Gordon Koch speaks with Tuse King about what she heard at the Tantramar Green Resilience Conversation, and also with conversation participant and new Sackville resident Sally Davis, who points out that climate anxiety can be even worse for people of color and immigrants who are already dealing with racism and bias. And then we'll hear from epidemiologist Catherine Clace. As Omicron continues to surge, we are hearing more and more evolving rules and recommendations around masks. As a member of the clothmasks.ca network, Clace has explored the mask question extensively and shares what she knows with us today. That's coming up right after some more local news and information. The woodblock building on Bridge Street in Sackville has sold. The deal closed late last Thursday when John Ernst took over ownership of the historic building. The woodblock is currently home to a number of businesses, from Ducky's Pub down to the Fog Forest Gallery, as well as a number of apartments. The new owner, John Ernst, is the son of Tara Beata boss David Ernst, the owner of Sackville's beloved Cube on Crescent Street. CHMA has reached out to John Ernst to find out his plans for the Heritage Building, which was once home to the Imperial Theatre and the Sackville Music Hall. Mount Allison released its weekly update on Tuesday and says there are now 21 self-reported active positive COVID cases amongst the Mount Allison University community. 9 of the cases are in students in residence and 12 are in students, faculty, or staff living off campus. Since last week, an additional 24 new cases have been self-reported to the school, for a total of 62 cases since January 3rd. That number includes self-reported cases from individuals who are not presently on campus or in Sackville. Mount Allison has also extended its timeline to go back to in-person classes by 1 week, with a new target of Monday, February 7th. Sackville will host another vaccination clinic this Saturday, geared specifically to help those under 30 get their booster shots. People 29 and under are being given the Pfizer vaccine exclusively, due to an increased risk for that age group with the Moderna vaccine. Local pharmacist Charles Beaver says he hopes about 600 young people can get their booster shot through the clinic, happening on Saturday at the Mount Allison Athletic Center. People must register in advance at thecornerdrugstore.ca. We've all seen how the disruption of the pandemic has reached into nearly all aspects of our lives, from how we seek entertainment to how we make our livelihoods. And we've seen how the upheaval has affected the most vulnerable in society the most. The same pattern is poised to repeat itself with regard to the other global emergency we're facing, the effects of climate change. A group of people in the Tantramar region tried to address that topic head-on recently in a discussion about green resilience, addressing climate impacts and their corresponding threats to income security. Here's David Gordon Koch with more.
Extreme weather and climate change are growing concerns for many residents of the Tantramar area. Income security is also top of mind for many people, especially in the wake of economic upheaval caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. Those were topics of conversation at a recent workshop bringing together area residents as part of the Green Resilience Project. The project received funding through the Federal Climate Action and Awareness Fund and involves a series of 25 to 35 conversations across the country on the links between community resilience, income security, and the shift to a low-carbon economy. Among the participants at last week's virtual workshop were Sally and Clinton Davis. Their family recently moved to the Tantramar region, where they have already noticed extreme weather patterns.
When I first moved here, I remember our first windstorm. I asked the neighbors if this was normal. They laughed. They said it became normal, but it wasn't like this. So we have a large amount of property, and at the bottom of our property, there is the train and the river. And when we look at the river, sometimes it looks like it's going to swallow the train tracks whole. We have children. We want them to have a planet that's not a dump to live in. But also we have seen the effects of climate change and we are worried.
Sally is the host of a podcast called We Can Fight Like Cats about the experiences of people of color and immigrants in New Brunswick. Her partner, Clinton Davis, is one of the hosts of Black in the Maritimes, a podcast about the experiences of Black people in the region. Sally is concerned poor economic conditions in New Brunswick will lead to the racist scapegoating of immigrants and people of color like herself.
We're all stressed by the environmental factor, but immigrants and people of color have an additional stress, which is also we are disliked for being people of color. We are discriminated against for being people of color. And so we can't even focus on the problem of surviving climate change if we're having the problem of just general survival from a population that is deprived of basic human decency and basic human rights. And so they're looking to blame someone, and they typically blame people of color and immigrants. But there's a whole other side of this as well that has nothing to do with culture, which is our biggest employer in New Brunswick is one of the biggest carbon footprint in the world. And we just have accepted this because we are so desperate as New Brunswickers. We are so desperate as immigrants. We are so desperate as human beings trying to survive that we've accepted this as a source of income, essentially poisoning our earth one square inch at a time at a rapid pace, causing tremendous damage. If we want to change this culture to be environmental, we need to start holding the top accountable rather than the lower levels accountable.
That was Tantramar area resident Sally Davis, one of the participants in a virtual workshop that took place recently as part of the Green Resilience Project. The session was facilitated by Margaret Tuse King, a project consultant with the Sackville-based Aster Group Cooperative. Here's Margaret.
Unfortunately, during any times of upheaval and change, it's the most vulnerable who lose the most. And so this is a project that's really focused on hearing from the people most vulnerable and contributing to federal policy through Environment and Climate Change Canada, so that hopefully decision makers will take into account the concerns and realities that these Canadians are facing.
How do you see climate action linked with income security or anti-poverty efforts?
Well, the effects of climate change are going to affect all of us, right? You know, if we have wetter springs and falls and drier summers, you know, what we're dealing with a lot of risks around ice and floods and storms and things like that. But when you have enough money, you can manage, right? You can buy the air conditioner, you can pay more for the power, you can pay more for the food, you can buy food from further away when the local crops fail due to drought. When you don't have enough money already, that's the tipping point. You know, when people don't have enough money to pay for their homes, for food, for healthcare, for, you know, all of those things that we're concerned about, or you become an isolated island because flooding has cut you off and you don't have appropriate transportation. There are so many ways that it's just somebody at the session said, everything's harder when you don't have enough money. And quite frankly, things are hard already for a huge proportion of people in our region.
What were some of the ideas that came out of the session?
The solutions were very much related to the public understanding the urgency of this so we can advocate with decision makers, i.e. governments, to set up programs and act more quickly. The biggest barrier identified was ourselves. We're not taking this seriously enough. We've been talking about climate change for decades, and all of a sudden we're shocked when something happens like happened in BC with the fires and then the floods and total disaster. And those had been predicted years and years ago, and things were not done. So there was all a great frustration named at ourselves and our community. But that said, there was also a huge recognition that here in Tantramar, we have this network of social capital. People know each other. We live in a very caring community where individuals are known for who they are. We don't often get lost in a crowd around here. We have an ability to mobilize a lot of people. And we have, with the pandemic, we've demonstrated that. We have really, really good people in our community who care. That is a huge strength that we have. We also have this amazing experience of having had the CERB from the government. And when people started getting $2,000 a month, the usage at the food bank decreased. It shows how little we need in basic income to make the difference for people to be economically independent and autonomous. It doesn't take that much. That's the level of poverty that we have, and that's the level of income that we need. That's not that much.
A moment ago, you were saying that a lot of the discussion focused on people's concerns about climate change in and I think economic security in the region. Could you talk a little bit about what came up?
Well, a lot of people obviously are worried about flooding. We have the sea level rising, so anybody who lives in a coastal area is at risk. But also at risk is the Trans-Canada Highway and the railway line, because the railway line basically is the dike that's been protecting us. When the Acadians built those dikes over 400 years ago, we very happily built a lot of infrastructure and put a lot of homes inside the dikes at sea level. So when the tides are high, when we have a big storm and the dikes are overtopped, which is what's being predicted, we have a lot of our people and infrastructure and communities at risk. So there's a real concern about that, and how are we going to address the dikes? There's been studies going on for more than 10 years about that, and jurisdictional issues with the provinces and the federal government have been, you know, these barriers, and things are moving along at a snail's pace. They are moving, but, you know, by my standards, a little too slowly. So that's a big issue. I don't know if you've noticed, we're having more ice storms rather than snow storms. People were worried with all that. Who cleans up the ice and does the shoveling? Essential workers who are low paid. We're always trying to solve our problems on the backs of low paid essential workers. The health problems that could ensue, slip and fall accidents due to the ice. With climate, we're getting worse and worse air quality. So we're going to get asthma and breathing problems. When we have droughts and floods, and how do farmers plan? How do you know what to grow this year when it was extra dry in 2020 and extra wet in 2021? We're going to have inconsistent food supplies, and our local growers are going to have inconsistent incomes. How do we manage that when we all know we should be growing more local food just for just to get by? I don't know if you were at the grocery store in the past week or so, but when the trucks couldn't get through, the shelves were bare. We don't have a lot of food locally. It all has to be trucked in when transportation lines are down, when borders are closed, or for whatever reason. It's a real challenge. So there were a whole bunch of layers, and coupled on top of all of that was mental health. We already have poor mental health generally across the population. When we have uncertainty, when we don't have access to resources that we need for food security or for transportation or for healthy homes, that just makes it worse. And this is going to be long-term, multi-generational effects that these challenges have on people. This isn't just, oh, it's going to be better next year. These are going to have long-term ramifications if we don't invest in people and invest in the supports and structures and systems that we need for everyone to be resilient, not just a few wealthy people.
How important do you think it is for people to be meeting up in these public forums to talk about issues like climate change and poverty and trying to come up with solutions?
I think it's the only way. There's that Margaret Mead quote I can never remember about never doubt. You know, change happens when people lead it. And what I really appreciated about this conversation I was invited to lead was that we're bringing together, oh, all of us who've been talking for ages and ages about climate change, together with, oh, all of us who've been talking about income and poverty and inclusion, and bringing that together, because there was a recognition by everybody that it's all interconnected. We pretend that these issues are experienced in silos, but the reality is they're all interconnected, and the solution has to be an interconnected, comprehensive approach. I think it was this week or last week, Oxfam had a report that the 10 richest men in the world together hoarded more money than, you know, any government spent on bailouts during the pandemic. The difference between the rich and the poor is unimaginable. And if the answer is for people to have more money to put into an economy that is fair, that shifts us away from carbon, I mean, what a great solution that would be for humankind.
That was Margaret Tuse King, facilitator of a recent workshop that took place as part of the Green Resilience Project. The project involves a series of 25 to 35 conversations on the links between community resilience, income security, and the shift to a low carbon economy across the country. She recommended that anyone interested in local work on climate change connect with the Sackville-based organization EOS Eco-Energy. For people interested in issues of income security, she recommended contacting either the Sackville Food Bank or PEDVAC, a community organization in Port Elgin. For issues affecting the Memramcook-Tantramar region more broadly, she suggested listeners connect with the Memramcook-Tantramar Community Task Force. You can get on their email list by emailing memramcooktantramartaskforce@gmail.com, that's one word, or by checking out their Facebook page.
Rules and recommendations around mask use have been evolving throughout the pandemic, and the Omicron wave, with its incredible transmissibility, is bringing yet another set of changes. Recently, Mount Allison instructed its students, staff, and faculty to stop using their cloth masks in favor of medical-grade surgical masks or N95 or KN95 respirators. Education Minister Dominic Carty recently spoke to a return-to-school plan, which includes a call for students to bring three-layer masks to school, while a supply of medical-grade masks has been secured for teachers and school staff. Dr. Catherine Clace is a nephrologist, epidemiologist, and professor at McMaster University. In the pandemic, she joined McMaster's Center of Excellence in Protective Equipment and Materials, where she works on community education around cloth masks and developing better cloth masks. I called her up to get advice on what masks we should be wearing. So when it comes to masks, we've been reading a lot lately. More and more experts seem to be coming to the conclusion that cloth masks are not sufficient to prevent the spread, particularly when it comes to the Omicron variant. What's your conclusion? Have you come to any newer, like more recent conclusions than when you first started looking into mask use during this pandemic?
I think that's a really good question, and we've all re-examined our priorities with Omicron and the increased transmissibility of this variant. So my bottom line is any mask is better than no mask, and that's still true. But I think it's important now that everybody knows a little more about masks and wears the best mask that they have access to, and I'm hoping we can talk about what that means.
Right. Yeah. So any mask. So you wouldn't say that people, I mean, shouldn't bother wearing cloth masks. You're saying a cloth mask is still useful, but there are better options out there. What are the best options in your view?
So when we talk about the best mask, what are we basing that on? We're basing it on filtration science, because what we're trying to do is trap aerosols in air. And we're very comfortable now making recommendations on the basis of the aerosol science and on the basis of the filtration properties of the masks. So the best masks are what are technically called respirators. These are characterized by N95 designation or the new CAN95 designation or CAN99, which is an even slightly higher standard. So these are masks which, if fit tested on an individual, will provide more than 95% protection from very small particles. And even unfit tested, even if you take a group of unselected people, some of whom happen to fit and some of whom don't, you can still expect to see above 90% filtration. Even in prolonged use, there's one study of more than 100 hours of use, there's still looking at greater than 80% filtration. So this means that the N95, CAN95, CAN99 are really what people should be thinking of as the best mask right now. But they're expensive, they're hard to source, and it's difficult to buy them individually if you are on a tight budget and you just want to buy one or two. They come in packs of 20 and 25. And so we recognize that not everybody has access to masks in this respirator standard. So the next best thing is probably double masking, which is a cloth mask over a medical mask. Now, there's very limited information available about this in the literature, but medical masks are made of really good filtration material, but we are all aware, having worn them and looked at other people wearing them, that they have gaps around the sides. Our cloth masks, particularly well-designed cloth masks, can fit really well. So the combination of a really well-fitting cloth mask over the top of a medical mask gives you the filtration of the medical mask and the fit of the cloth mask. And in the limited data that we have, that does improve the filtration efficiency of the whole thing. So on the same scale as the N95s, where I was saying, you know, above 95% if you're fit tested, but above 90% even without being fit tested, probably, double masking is coming in at about 50 to 75%. Medical masks are about 40 to 80%, so they're not really in the same category as N95s and CAN95s. And cloth masks have been tested between 30 and 50%. So you can see that some good cloth masks are in the same range as medical masks. And the problem is identifying the cloth mask that's a good cloth mask. The other thing I want to say is that when we talk about medical masks and the ones that have been studied in the literature, they're certified medical masks that have an ASTM designation. A lot of what people are wearing that look like medical masks, you know, blue masks that we buy in the drugstore, those are not certified masks, and we really don't know what kind of filtration they offer.
So that would be your sort of standard disposable mask that we see everywhere,
yeah,
that may not be medically certified.
That's right. We shouldn't confuse the disposable drugstore mask with an ASTM certified medical mask, because the ones that are tested in the literature are the medical masks, and we have very little information about procedure masks.
I've read that, you know, we've read three layers is the sort of gold standard in cloth masks. So when you talk about the percentages there, of filtration, is that looking at a three-layer cloth mask that fits well?
Yes, exactly. So the problem here is that the literature on cloth masks and their filtration doesn't really include a lot of detail about the design of the mask and the fit of the mask. So we think that what we need are studies where we actually look at the materials and we look at the fit, and we're doing studies like that at McMaster right now to try and figure out what combinations of materials and designs give you filtration at the high end of that range. But if people are looking at their cloth mask and trying to decide whether it's a good cloth mask to continue to use or to use over the top of a medical mask or a drugstore disposable mask, if that's what you have, then what you can look for is the number of layers. So three layers is great. And the way that it fits on your face. So we know that if you can see gaps under the eyes and around the edges, then there's going to be leak that comes through those gaps, and that air is going to be completely unfiltered. So what you're looking for is a snug fit under the chin and on both sides, and a good fit under the nose. So a nose wire can help. We also think over-the-head attachments can help, because we think that anything that kind of tensions the mask on the face is likely to improve the fit, and the better the fit, the better the net filtration of the mask.
What about the extra layer of, and people are saying polypropylene as a non-woven material, using that as a third layer in an otherwise cotton mask. Is that shown to be added filtration properties?
We really would expect that it would improve filtration. And in fact, that's one of the interventions that we're looking at in our study of design and materials as cloth masks. And we work with a stakeholder group called the Cloth Mask Knowledge Exchange, and they have donated designs and put them in the public domain. So when our work's finished, we'll have ideas about, and we'll have published patterns for better cloth masks. But I think it's unlikely that we're going to get to respirator standards within the next 6 months with reusable cloth masks. So right now, when we're dealing with Omicron, we are really looking at using the best mask possible. Right. And that best mask is an N95. The middle layer in cloth masks almost certainly helps. Middle layer of anything almost certainly helps. And the polypropylene we expect to be better than a middle layer, say, of another layer of cotton. But the kind of polypropylene that's used in cloth masks, the kind that's washable, is called spun bond. Whereas there's another kind of polypropylene which has a finer structure called melt blown, and that's what you find in certified medical masks. That's not washable, but it's a much better filter, and that's why we recommend using, if you have it, a medical mask under your cloth mask to get the benefit of both the great filtration of the melt blown middle layer in a medical mask with the great fit of your well-designed cloth mask on top.
I know one of the considerations for people will be that reusability. I mean, I know I've built up quite a convenient supply of cloth masks. I can wash them on the regular. With respirators and with medical masks, what's the reusability? How many times can we use them, and how often do they need to be replaced?
The material, the actual filtration material, is not going to disintegrate or deteriorate with use. That's the first thing to say, the actual filtration properties. What will change is it will get soiled. If it's soiled with mucus on the inside, it should be replaced. If it's externally soiled or damaged, or if the straps get torn, then it should be replaced. But otherwise, if it looks clean and it's just damp, it can be put in a paper bag and allowed to dry out for 24 hours and then reused. And for respirators, there are data that they're still filtering at above 80% after 100 hours of use. So these are average figures, and not every respirator is actually going to survive 100 hours of use. But it does suggest that if what you're doing is fairly short-term use of masks, like you wear one to go to a shop or an appointment, for example, then you may actually be able to get a lot of use out of your N95. Ideally, you want to have two or maybe even four so that you can rotate them and you're not putting on one that might be contaminated from recent use. So one option is to keep paper bags in the front hall, and every family member has a couple of paper bags and a couple of masks, and the masks are allowed to dry, and then they're rotated so that you don't wear the one that you wore yesterday. So what I've been quoting there comes from N95s, but if you have good quality medical masks that you want to use more than once, you could apply that to the same advice to the use of medical masks. Put them in a paper bag and let them dry.
Okay. Thank you so much for your time today, Catherine. Is there anything you wanted to add before we let you go?
Oh, thank you. Yes, I'd like to direct people to our website, clothmasks.org, which has information about cloth masks, but we also have a Find N95 page, and we have a very short list of curated lists which will direct you to manufacturers that are making reliable masks. So I hope people find that useful. Obviously, we're interested in making reusable masks in the end, but right now, at this point in the pandemic, wear the best mask you have access to.
That was Dr. Catherine Klase, an epidemiologist with McMaster University. That's it for CHMA's Tantramar report for this Wednesday, January 26th. As always, we hope you'll get in touch with your comments or questions at news@chmafm.com. I'm Erica Butler. Thanks for listening.